listener production.
How do you get people as they're developing products to think about the accessibility of it? You know, the average age of a farmer is now 65. We have this aging workforce. How do you help build products that are going to help them to be able to continue to farm efficiently?
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips and welcome back to The Good Oil. Now, you know by now, giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff and the real stuff, which is exactly what we do on this podcast. We bring you conversations with entrepreneurs, executives and experts, the people who know what's going on and the people who make things happen. As usual, today's guest is someone who really does know what's going on and frankly is making a lot of things happen, both the someone who has experience in her field and someone who's determined to make a difference in a very specific way. Josie Clark, welcome to The Good Oil.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mate, it is absolutely my pleasure. Can I start by saying, by way of sharing a little bit with our listeners in terms of who you are, I found this profile of you and it simply starts this way. Agronomist, research assistant, PhD candidate in gene editing for crop improvement and passionate disability advocate, Josie Clark is a powerhouse, end quote. I think that's a pretty good rap, mate. And there's a lot going on there. We are going to get to Ability Agriculture, which is the organization you founded. I'm going to start, though, with the PhD candidacy. What are you hoping to find or to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm doing my PhD for gene editing for crop improvement around nitrogen use efficiency and tolerance in cereal crops. I'm working with rice and corn at the moment. And I'm originally from a farm as well, as you probably find out. And for me, research, I've always just loved genetics. I always love being on the farm, being like, how does this thing bloody work? And how can we make it better? And yeah, genetics just always stood out to me because I was fascinated by it. And I actually went to uni not even studying agriculture. I just did a Bachelor of Science and fell back into agriculture when I was like, oh, maybe I like human genetics and all these things. But I think for me, I'm very realistic about research and practical research that I could hopefully see back on a farmer's farm one day. And I think that's what I really enjoy about what I get to do and choosing projects that really align with what I want to do. So but I see, like, I guess gene editing and crop improvement, there's various different ways you can do it. So it starts from the farm and a farmer having good agronomy and water use efficiency through practical methods through to years and years of traditional breeding, which is just crossing different parents and trying to get the best traits out of them. And then I see gene editing as another part of the solution. It's not the whole solution, but it's those things that we can't genetically change. It's things that'll never change unless we can identify these tiny little switches and tiny little bits of DNA that can actually make a huge difference. So yeah, it's when, you know, I feel like sometimes it's hard for people when you talk about exons, that, you know, if you just turn off one exon, it actually helps this plant completely reject a disease. It can't get in it. There's all these kinds of molecular things that can help so much. And it's something that I think, gene editing and GMO has been done so much for human medicine, and it's very well widely accepted. But as soon as you start talking about food and human consumptive food, it becomes a different story. And so it's been really great just having that open conversation around differences between what gene editing is and GMO. So I like to say gene editing is working with the same cake recipe, whereas GMO is, you know, if I bought a fish gene into a plant, that's GMO. So it's bringing foreign DNA into, or a foreign mechanism into another organism. So, you know, I've had supervisors that have created gene edits that have completely built resistance to this disease that they've been working for 50 years on across Africa. And wherever this disease is in corn in Africa, it completely wipes out the corn, and the level of poverty and just nutritional deficiencies is quite high. And yeah, it was fascinating. And they've got it out in the field last year, and I think that was through Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And that's the sort of things that gene editing are part of this solution, but can have a massive impact globally for a lot of people as well. So Yeah, I don't know if that gives you a good overview.
No, that's super cool, mate. Just fascinating. The boundaries of science are going so incredibly quickly. I can remember, I'm old enough to, older than you, back in around the 2000, the early 2000, when they were talking about, you know, could we possibly map the human genome? And that was a years-long project. And the combination of the advance of scientific knowledge and frankly, the advance in technology and the speed of computing has just taken, you know, 25-odd years since then. The opportunities are phenomenal. It's really cool. I love the analogy of the cake recipe versus the foreign body or the foreign agent. I think it's a really, really nice way to kind of describe what gene editing is. Obviously, we're already doing it. To your point, you know, your supervisor's been able to turn a particular gene off, or if that's the right phrasing, to solve that. How far is there to go? How much opportunity have we got? What's the holy grail for gene editing in agriculture?
I honestly think it's just the regulation of it is the biggest hindrance. And I'm someone who I believe that definitely you need to have good regulation. I think for a lot of people, it's scary, this unknown thing. But for me, it's, you know, a lot of people don't understand how we create these things and that actually we do all the checks and crosses as we go. But also we're not using these materials that people might have these conspiracy theories of, you know, lasers coming out of plants and all these things. But I think that the biggest thing is just that understanding and global policy. So European Union is probably one of the biggest controllers of agricultural policy, and it's something for Australian farmers that they have to consider. So I have a farmer come to me and say, can you gene edit this, you know, salt tolerance, or can you gene edit something so the plants stop, you know, falling over when there's a windy day? And the thing for Australian farmers is that our rules in Australia might allow gene-edited crops and food consumptive crops to be grown, but we're a 70% export of our agricultural produce. So where we're sending that, if their rules don't cover what we've let them grow in the paddock, then they can't sell it. So that's the biggest kind of, I guess, Australian what would be holding it back. I think it'll, you know, you can use cotton as a really good example, and that's because it's non-food consumptive. It's obviously a fiber, being those GMO with BT genes so that, you know, the insects could naturally eat the plant and die from the BT gene being in the cotton. And it reduced massive amounts of spraying, which is a really awesome environmental benefit. And so I think that's just the thing. It's around food consumptive crops and global policy. It's a massive hindrance. I think the technology's there. It's quite efficient with what we do. And, you know, there's always things that in that tiny little nitty gritty that you can say, oh, we can make this better and make the gene edits quicker, or we can do multiple gene edits in the one system, in the one round. There's those kinds of things in the technology side that are always happening. Which is, yeah, really fascinating. So, yeah, I think there's always room for innovation, but I think the practical toolkit we use to do it, it's there. It doesn't need, yeah, it's been really well, like you said, you've heard about it for a long time. But the reason it's probably not out there as much is just the around that regulation and policy and that broader community understanding as well. So,
super cool. Thank you for sharing some of that. That's an amazing conversation. Maybe you should have another time. We are here, though, to talk most particularly about Ability Agriculture. Now, it's a not-for-profit that you founded. You have obviously some personal experience that led you to this. Maybe if you wouldn't mind, I will just kind of ask what led you to this point, and then we'll talk a bit more about the organization itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from a beef cattle farm on the north coast of New South Wales, a town called Kempsey. The local council likes to say it's the river meets the sea. Yeah, I think it's the best of both worlds. It's really lovely being able to do some cattle work and then going and swimming at the beach. And my dad also had a transport business as well. When I was 5 years old, he had a truck accident. Straight to rural North Shore, and he became a paraplegic. So that those 2 years of in and out and going to Sydney and visiting dad and all those things was something we just did when I was that young. And the biggest thing for us is when, you know, dad came home, and it was, you know, is just as soon as dad was in the hospital too, it was, you know, you should think about doing a different job, or you should think about selling the farm. And that's kind of embedded all the way from the beginning from the hospital. And just how do we adjust and how do we do these things? And, you know, for me, it was definitely not easy. We had another property that my dad managed for my grandfather. And as soon as my dad had his accident, my grandfather thought, you know what, there's no more opportunity here, and ended up selling that property fairly soonly after as well. So it was something that personally for us, it was, we were always looking out for the next story and who else is out there, what have they done, what can we do? And it was just a constant cycle for us trying to find resources that just didn't exist. And there was no industry resource either of how do you reskill or stay in agriculture after a workplace accident, or how do you enter agriculture if you've got a certain impairment, just doesn't exist. So, yeah. And then as I grew up, I obviously worked in agriculture. So I've worked in horticulture and on horticulture farms, and also in grains research and on large grains farms as well. And it was just something we don't talk about is just accessibility in agriculture. You know, I might be at a field day presenting to farmers on my research in the middle of a clay soil and it's a wet day. There's no way in hell my dad's getting his fields through that. Yeah. So, you know, there's those things where it was just something we just didn't even talk about. So for me, it just started as sharing other people's stories, because obviously I know my dad's in agriculture, he's a farmer, but he's not the only one. And so it just started by that organic kind of, some people we obviously knew as family friends, but some people I found just online through TikTok or Instagram being like, hey, you've got a really great story, would you mind sharing this? And we started just building this online Facebook community group, basically to be that unofficial pooling of resources on, here's this random contraption I've had to make because no one can make it for me, or here's the best kind of materials for all those kinds of things. And that's where it kind of grew from. And pretty early on, I just knew that it could be so much more. I think for me, it was, okay, I'm sharing all these stories, they're getting really great engagement, but nothing's physically changing in the industry, you know, besides this. And that's the thing too. I think the biggest thing for me was, in my head, I'd read these stories as, this is great, this is another person who works in agriculture. And I think for a lot of people, it was, you know, I know we talk about inspiration porn, and it's kind of what I didn't want it to be in a weird way. And it was, oh, if they can do it, I can do it. And it's like, for me, it's like, no, this person should be able to work in agriculture and this is normal. And it was just normalizing this kind of conversation around, this is a normal thing for a person with a disability impairment to be able to work in agriculture, to be able to run an agribusiness. So, yeah, I was fortunate enough to be put onto a rural program for women. And that kind of helped me start thinking about, what does this want to look like? You know, besides me just doing this in my spare time, you know, how could this have impact? And it was the good kind of first stepping stone for me to be able to think about being able to form it as a not-for-profit and a company, which comes with a lot of background work that no one tells you about. So that was a fun last year, I think. So, and that was, I think, as well for me, I think I had a lot of people around me, but I wish they just kind of patted me on the shoulder earlier and say, hey, you know, you could do this, and this is how you could actually make this more sustainable and all these things. I think I looked back and I was like, I had all these people saying, oh, this is, you're doing a great job. But it was like, hey, what do you need help with? What do you want this to look like? No one ever asked me that. And it's something, until I kind of went through that program, I realized, oh, okay, I need to have a better structure and think about these things, what I want it to look like, what could it have impact as? So that was the kind of next stage for me. And yeah, so with that program, I was able to do my director's course, which I think is incredibly valuable for a lot of people. And it was really weird because I was only 25 at the time, or 24, doing the director's course. And if you, I only was able to do it through that program because they had a scholarship to do it. But if you read the things for doing the director's course, is that you need to have X amount of executive experience, X amount of all these things. And I was like, I don't even qualify for this course if I wanted to pay for it myself. And yet I got the highest score in the testing. And I was like, a lot of this for me was common sense, but you know, this course is telling me I can't do it because I'm basically too young and too inexperienced. And that was a big thing for me, being like, you know, there's so many incredible young people out there with diverse experience. And that's one of the biggest things the director course kind of taught me as well, is that, you know, the more diverse your board is, the more better outcomes and decision-making that happens. And I was like, for me, if you look at the majority of agricultural boards, they're not particularly diverse. And I know they're starting to change that now, but a lot of them still aren't. you have a certain demographic on agricultural boards that I don't think I even need to name.
I think I can probably guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like there's just so many incredible young people that for me on that can have that insight and experience. And you know, we talk about succession planning and all these problems for young people in agriculture, but we have no young people on sitting on boards to help inform. Hey, actually, this would be a really practical solution that would work for us. You're not really asking us and letting us having that opportunity to develop as leaders either. So that's a whole rant I could probably go on in itself. But it set me up to really form, I think, one of the most diverse boards of an agricultural kind of organization. And that's something I'm really proud of. So over 85% of my board are either members with disability or direct family members with disability. Over 60% of us are female as well. And from diverse backgrounds with really great skills, but all of us are from regional areas in the show. And I think that's something else we really need to celebrate as well, as the talent and skills that come from regional people and the insights and that they can really share. And, you know, I talked to my friend in the city the other day and she was like, just baffled by just knowing that you don't have service in a rural area. I have a friend who couldn't trade his grain, and how much of an economic impact that makes to him on the farm because of that lack of access to signal and internet. And she's like, she wouldn't even never even thought about it before. So, you know, there's all these kinds of things around regional people as well that are quite valuable and different experiences that you might not even know about as well. So I think I can talk about, if you like, just the background of the registration, because that was a process in itself. And I think for a lot of people who are maybe starting a not-for-profit, mm-hmm. is things you might want to consider, those kinds of things. If you want
I want to roll back a little bit to the foundations of the organization. Then we'll definitely get back to that, because we have a lot of entrepreneurs listening to us or people who are looking to do that. And we kind of talk about entrepreneurs a lot, I think, in society as for-profit entrepreneurship. But as you say, there's a whole lot of not-for-profit work being done, and maybe that's not talked about enough, or certainly not talked about enough. In terms of the foundation, what I liked about the way you kind of described it is that kind of the concentric circle. You start with saying, you know, what can I do? And then it's what can others do? But then the third biggest circle, and frankly, as an organization and as a society, that thing of how can the rest of us make sure we are inclusive in those different ways. You mentioned the on clay soil on a wet day, and it's not something that, frankly, a lot of people would have thought about, I'm sure. I mean, unless you've had direct experience with it, it's not the first thing that would come to mind. You walk onto a place like that, not considering what someone in a wheelchair would be able to do or not do in that context. And so that bit, I think, just maybe talk through those kind of that progress, you know, going from your own experience into the Facebook group, then to the actually, we can talk about us, but it's actually them. Those of us who aren't, dealing with disability, I don't mean in a negative sense, but having to overcome those challenges. But those of us who can simply make things easier, better, just simply more accessible, more equal for those people who don't have the same opportunities, who have maybe mobility issues or other things.
Absolutely. So we actually did an independent report last year at a field day. Me and Dad took his modified gaiter and just had some resources there to meet people on the ground, which is really lovely. But we did a survey because for me, you know, a lot of the ABS statistics or the existing statistics out there just aren't asking the right questions for rural and regional Australia. So, and for agriculture and for us, the big thing around disability confidence. And so, you know, we asked a question, do you believe that agriculture is an accessible industry for people with disability? We just asked it straight out, you know, and it was over 80% said no, or they weren't sure. And so for us, it was, okay, well, why is that? Why is there no like transparency or access to resources for persons in regional communities around disability, accessibility, or, you know, how do I even employ someone with a disability? Because they've never done it before as well. So for us, that helped inform what we've just launched two services this year, but one of them is called the Ability AgriCheck, and that is an accessibility feedback service. And it's understanding that a lot of the existing, I guess, accessibility kind of assessment organizations that are out there that are large corporations now, they're very much tailored for a corporate environment and not particularly for a regional kind of area as well. And so for us, it was about how do we build a checklist that we know is tailored for agriculture and also will help bring people to the table. For me, it was, there's no good point in me saying you're the worst person in the world because you've never even thought about employing a person with disability. It's asking what's the biggest barrier for you to be able to, you know, think about this, or, you know, what are those prior misconceptions, or is it lack of access to resources or time and all those things. So, our Ability AgriCheck service is basically, you know, we have a checklist. It's aimed at a model. So if we get a job in Wagga and there's a local rural store that would like someone to come through and do a secret shopper, you know, was it easy for me to park? Was it easy for me to ask for assistance from your staff? Or did they feel confident to assist me? Was there a nonverbal way to ask for assistance or do online shopping? All these things you don't really think about for rural services that have probably never been asked before. And kind of go through getting them to give that feedback to that organization and say, this is what you're doing really great, but this is what you're doing really that could maybe be improved. But the biggest thing with that AgriCheck is we have a symbol now with it. So if you do an AgriCheck, then you can have this symbol that you can display on the front of your store saying, you know, we're working towards inclusion and accessibility. And that gives that transparency there. It you know, for us, I've had people tell me, you know, I don't apply for jobs in agriculture because I'm too scared that I need to tell them I can't do certain things, like, you know, or I don't think they're going to employ me as soon as I let them know I have a certain impairment. For us, the biggest practical solution is just empowering businesses to start with, is just around that accessibility, transparency. And that's something that's really simple and not this daunting thing to do. And for that as well, we've extended that out to opening it up to developing ag tech or ag products as well. How do you get people as they're developing products to think about the accessibility of it? You know, the average age of a farmer is now 65. So there's a massive market there that you need to make accessible products, because my pop was on the farm until he was nearly 70 as well. And it's like, you know, if we have this aging workforce, how do you help build products that are going to help them to be able to continue to farm efficiently and get them to think about with their product? Have you ever thought about how your product is helping create meaningful work for people with disability and how this could be eligible for the Employment Assistance Fund? Have you ever thought about, hey, your product could potentially be NDIS registerable and some of their NDIS funding could potentially use that funding to be able to implement your product? You know, for me, it's simple things that are big changes, but it's a win-win for everyone in a way. And for us, that's the biggest kind of thing around our advocacy and awareness in helping change that. And so for, you know, events, like if we were out in a field day, it's here's your accessibility transparency list. So for Dad, he doesn't need to try and ring up and say, oh, hey, by the way, it's here it is before the event. Here you go. Here's our AgriCheck accessibility list. If you need someone to directly contact, here's our contact number. And here you go. You know what's there before you even are going there. So you can say, okay, I can go to this event. Whereas some people before will be like, I don't think I can go to this event because I don't know. So those are things for us where it's, like I said, it was, you know, sharing these stories and nothing was changes for us. We're now in that position to say, what are practical services that would help build the disability confidence of agriculture and agribusinesses and agri-services?
I like that. I'm curious. I mean, obviously, part of it is awareness raising. Part of it is, I guess, I don't know. I'm not sure how, again, not having worked in this area, I'm not sure how quickly society and maybe agriculture, maybe regions are better or worse than this. I'm not sure. Is prepared to, ready to, you know, kind of happy to adapt to some of this stuff. There must be some people out there who are like, another thing I have to do. You know, the AgriCheck idea, brilliant idea. There's going to be some people like, oh, I just don't want to have to deal with that. Don't want to have to do that. Can I just pretend it's not there? How hard has it been? How easy has it been to kind of raise these and say, hey, with a little bit of extra effort, sure, you can make your business, your organization, your event a whole lot more accessible, a whole lot more, frankly, fair, reasonable for people who otherwise do have accessibility issues in one form or another.
I think, you know, the biggest thing for us is understanding that there's obviously large corporates in agriculture that you know, we work with that are straight on board because they have an inclusion and diversity policy and all those things. But the majority of agriculture is a lot of smallholders and the small family farms as well. And so for us, it's how do we make our resources available to them, and how do we work with others to be able to deliver these programs or just become on their radar and get them to start thinking about it. Because, you know, typical for me, it's you know, even at a field day with dad, you know, we have so many people come up and say, this is so needed. You know, this is my, I've got an uncle, I've got a brother, I've got a father, I've got a, you know, my mum. That happens all the time at field days when we go to an event. But we also have that one person that comes and say, oh, you know, but is it really, you know, achievable? Or is it, you know, is that, you know, it's not really the most important thing, or, you know, so I think the biggest thing for me is that, like, I've obviously grown up with farmers as well, and knowing how to have that conversation and kind of, you know, I think the biggest thing for me was, especially at an ag tech conference recently, you know, I had a little survey being like, have you ever thought about your ag tech and if it would be accessible for people with disability? And I definitely had a few people there at the ag tech really scared to be like, I don't think I want to, like, is this going to put my name on it? I was like,
right. Yeah.
Like, the whole point is that if you don't know or you're not sure, that's what we need to capture, because we need to show the industry this is a problem. Like, this is a problem that we need to change and say, you know, for someone with a brand new ag tech product to never have even thought about the accessibility of it, how are we not, you know, helping them in existing ag tech programs, get them to think about it? Like, it's something where, again, like I said, practical ways that we can do it. So, you know, for us, it's applying for grants where we could integrate in with existing field days and having a little workshop on, okay, if you actually, for instance, wanted to employ someone with a disability and help create meaningful work for them, here's an example of the Employment Assistance Fund, is that if that person was there to help with safety monitoring or water checking or going out and visually spotting during mustering, you can actually be eligible to support the purchase of a drone for that person, because it's helped create meaningful work. So kinds of grants we're applying for to help and give that physical example, because a lot of people in general, if they can't see it, they're not going to believe. Mm-hmm. So you can tell them, here's all these great programs and policies. How do I use it? Why is this a benefit to me? And how is this helping me along the way? So, and I guess another thing, it's understanding that people might not be prepared to do open employment for someone with a disability or impairment, but they might think about, you know, hey, there's actually, you know, my local town now, the main industry isn't agriculture anymore. It is services. So a lot of those disability support services are all in regional areas as well. How do we, you know, for a local farmer who might have a simple task like putting together crab pots every week, that's a really long task and repetitive task for them. How could they, you know, for them, it's like, oh, I'm actually looking for someone who could do a bit of work for me to do this. It's, you know, that's an opportunity where you could, if you knew it, you could actually go to the local disability employment service and say, hey, I've got this bit of work, contract work. Is this something that someone in your current, you know, business would like to maybe try as a day of work experience with the support worker? Or is it something that might be a form of meaningful employment? And I can maybe see what, you know, how that person's working with the support worker, how I could maybe help support them. Like, how do you make those stepping stones to open employment? Or just, if that's all a farmer ever does is go into a local disability employment service and help with contracting work, that's still a awesome thing to do. And I think, how do we help people show this isn't, like you said, some people might not have a lot of time and think, oh, this is another thing for me to do. Well, that's where these existing services in rural areas can really help. But who from the disability employment space is really reaching out to farmers at the moment as well? And that's something else for us we're not particularly seeing as much that we'd probably like to see. It's when you go email government and you have to email two different departments and they don't talk, even though the program and solution you're suggesting actually means this will be a beautiful project for regional employment. And the regional department, this would be a beautiful project for agriculture and a beautiful project for the disability support services, you know. So there's those kinds of things that are, you know, how do we practically do it, but how do you get all these different stakeholders in as well to help support you do it? It's just a fun thing I think everyone probably experiences every time they come up with a new project and think this would be great for having all these people on board, but they don't talk to each other. So so it's just those kinds of things. And I think, like I said, it's knowing how to work with people in agriculture is definitely a skill. I think a lot of people, it's can be a bit scary and intimidating for some people, but just having that experience of knowing how to, you know, you don't want to scare them away, but you also want to, you know, positively challenge them in a way and want them to engage in conversation. So that's a big thing that we definitely engage with when we're out talking to people in different areas.
I love that. A bit of knowledge and a bit of ability to kind of coordinate or communicate, provide some examples, kind of link some of that stuff together with a bit of know-how is obviously working wonders. Let's talk a little bit about that that process for you. You kind of referenced a little bit earlier the kind of, you know, and I suppose there's actually parallels, frankly, between what you did in terms of setting up the organization and others who are looking to work out whether they can or how they can, you know, offer opportunities for people with disability, because the whole don't know what you don't know thing seems like a pretty common theme. So let's do a bit of that for people listening. What were some of the challenges with setting up a not-for-profit, with trying to get from this is a good idea to I now have a sustainable organization with all of the things that need to be done and the people and the skills we need? What was that journey like for you?
So what I wish that was just there was just a toolkit. Are you wanting to start a not-for-profit?
Yeah.
Need a lawyer. Yeah. You're going to need a board. You're going to know how to form a board. Yeah. You're going to want to know that the ACNC is in a 9-month delay. So, you know, we were technically registered from March last year, but I didn't find out until September, October. So that put us in a massive holding pattern last year, being like, oh, we really want to donate to you, or we really want to do an event with you. And it's like, well, that's great. I'm not officially not eligible for this grant, but I'm also not officially eligible for this grant. Like, that was my constant thing last year that really held us back. So those are things you need to understand, like just the backlog of those formal processes as well. But, you know, I was lucky to have people reach out. So I had a not-for-profit mentor who had some template constitutions. Obviously, ACNC has some template constitutions. But just having a lawyer there and asking what do you want and tailoring that, I think is really important, because you know, what I learned as well is, like, you know, constitution is for your worst case scenario. So, you know, that those template ones might not necessarily cover your organization and what you're trying to do either. So it's just important to kind of have someone who understands what this all means and explain that to you. So that's a really important thing. And then, yeah, like I said, I did the director's course first before going into forming my board, but you need to have a board. You have to have at least, say, 3 board members, directors, to be able to register the entity. So that's something I had to do first before I could even go through that. Even though I had the constitution ready to go, it was, okay, now I need to form a board who wants to come together to be able to go through the registration process with me. So those are those kinds of key things you need to think about. And I was like, for our platform, we had a fair few following. So finding board members and from diverse backgrounds was okay. I just put a thing on LinkedIn. But if you're, I guess it depends what kind of organization you want to be. If you want to just be a community-focused one, you want to find diverse people of skills in your own little community group, that's really important. But I think it's also important in a way to have like an independent director as well, with oversight to come in that has no prior experience but can help be that governance as well. I think that's really important in small community organizations, just to help give them a bit of structure. Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's just the waiting time for young people as well with, I guess, social enterprise ideas in rural Australia. I think the biggest thing for me is you shouldn't, you know, if you have an idea for a business workshop in your local town, you shouldn't need to form a whole entity to apply for the grant. You should be able to go to your local council and be auspiced by them, but they won't advertise it. And it's like, how do you let young people know you don't need to go through registering a whole charity or not-for-profit just for a simple workshop or for something you think would be really benefit your community? Who's that community organization that has that structure that could auspice you? And that's, I think a big thing that would help a lot of people starting out. So for me, it was, I had to do grants for me as a person, not me as an organization. Like for Billy, it was me going through individual grant programs and using that money that was given to me to go back into this process of the costs associated around registration, which is actually a lot. It's not, you know, if you don't have a pro bono lawyer, you know, the cost is there. So I think for a lot of people's understanding that there can be a cost associated with doing this and just having a proper plan as you go into it, saying this is how much it's going to cost me to even do this. But like, don't just jump into it, plan for it. No, okay, I'm roughly going to have to wait 9 months' time. I'm going to need a lawyer. I'm going to need to form a board. I'm going to need to advertise for my board. There's all these different things, like practical things that you need to do just before you even are an entity. So, you know, and I think for us, especially as a young organization, is understanding for large government grants, Because we're not 5 years old, it means that you might want to be auspiced by a different organization when you're applying for larger government grants, because you're not seen as more high risk because you don't have 5 years worth of bank records or business operations. So that's something as well that people might not necessarily tell you. And then also auspicing comes with a lot of T's and C's, which is really important to know. It's, you know, understanding what that business is asking for from you and protecting your IP, or making sure that this is just an agreement for this grant. What's the management fee? You know, does this organization align with what we're trying to do as well? There's a lot of things around auspicing that are really important to consider as well, and to help you be eligible or to access funding. I think that's the biggest thing. But for us as well, is that I think it's important to think about your like entity as not, grant shouldn't be your sole source of income either. You know, for a lot of people, I think, you know, it can tend to be think that it's, how do you make it sustainable? And that's for us where we're starting to move into those services, because, you know, we shouldn't have to rely on, you know, 3 months periods of waiting to hear back from a grant. Oh, maybe we can run this workshop if we get this grant. Oh, we can't run it at all now because we don't have the grant. So for us, it's around negotiating, or just understanding, like, how do we build practical services that could help build sustainability of our business, and then also just navigating the philanthropic space and access to donors and things like that. So, you know, like I said, last year for us, we were technically a registered entity for that period, ACNC. So, you know, for organizations that are DGR2, they can only donate to DGR1. And those kinds of things we had to say no to because we weren't the proper entity just yet. So it's being aware of things like that. And I think for us, being a small, rurally founded charity, is like, you know, we obviously don't have any famous person behind us at the moment, which might be a really
not
good
yet, not yet.
Yeah. But I think just for us, you know, I'm not someone who, I know all the philanthropists in the world, and it's how do you get on the radar? How do you work with organizations that might? And I think that's something we're navigating at the moment of those kinds of things as well. And, you know, do you have a charity ambassador and all these different things? You know, is that valuable for your charity and helping get greater exposure to the broader public as well? Or how do you find people who want to help and support rural and regional Australia and you know, donate to organisations like ours kind of things? You know, how do you find those people and those pools of people? And do you need to be in the right room, or is it something you can cold email someone? You know, it's all those things. So, I think the biggest thing is it's a lot of work. Is don't underestimate the workload of it. And I know it's easy to say, oh, a constitution and oh, these things, but it is a lot of work. You know, it's, for me, it was interviewing all the directors, potential directors, and then getting them to meet. And, you know, how do I've never run a board meeting before, my first one. So that was, I was so nervous, my first board meeting. And I was kind of lucky for my mentor to just kind of, here's a rough template, but my chair is amazing. So, you know, it's something where, you know, in the first boarding meeting for me too was, I've done all this work over the past 2 years of my life. Here it is. What do we do? So that was a long board meeting, but it's been nice to learn over the past kind of 12 months, just efficient board meetings as well, straight to the point. This is where we're at. This is the update. This is what we need to do next. Is there any issues, or is there anything we haven't thought of? And here's a list of tasks and off we go kind of thing. So having a really good board template is really valuable. So, and I'm a firm believer in, you don't need to pay for every fancy board template software. Just open a Google Doc. It's really good. And you can tag everyone in their tasks, which is great, and it's for free. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's always a good price.
I will get to our favourite four questions in a second. If people want to find out more, whether they are prepared and ready to donate, whether they are listening in a regional area or in the agriculture industry and want to be part of this, whether they are someone in agriculture with a disability who would like to find some support, how can they find out more? How can they engage with Ability Agriculture?
Yeah, so we have our website, which is disabilityagriculture.com, but we actually have the Facebook group, which is a community group. So that's where people can organically just post and ask questions, which I think is the most valuable part. Obviously, the website, we don't have an open channel on that. So if you just look up Ability Agriculture on Facebook, you should be able to find our page, which then leads to the group organization kind of page. So that's something, you know, we can do. Also, I have lots of emails. You know, for me, I had a farmer who was partially vision impaired, you know, last week from WA, send me an email being like, you know, how do I adapt my farm? So I get all the emails being like, how do we do this?
Right.
So,
yeah,
and it's something that I ask them if they're happy for me to share to the group, then I'll share it and see if anyone else is out there. So, you know, I think the biggest thing for us is that organic kind of asking of questions is really helpful, but also it's one of the big things we'd like to, I guess, call for this year is just the building of an accessibility guideline for agriculture, because everyone has to start from scratch and they're still having to start from scratch like we had to do. And, you know, for us to get all these questions in our email inbox, it's like, well, it just shows you how little resources are out there to help people know how to adapt. So that's one of our big goals that would be a practical resource, I think, for everyone as well, not just people with disability, but for agribusinesses as well. So, but yeah, just to find that in Instagram as well. Yeah, you'll be able to find go to the website and I think you'll be able to find all the roads that lead to everywhere else, basically.
Awesome. That's abilityagriculture.com. Mate, let's finish with our favorite four questions. I listed at the beginning all the things you're doing currently. I'm not sure how much spare time you have, but to the extent you have any at all, what are you reading, watching, streaming, listening to at the moment?
I feel like I love Clarkson's Farm.
How good is that?
I just love being like, oh, I feel like I'm back on the farm again, or just like, I just love, Clarkson's Farm.
Is it not too painful, though? I'm not a farmer, right? I love Clarkson's Farm because he's funny in it, and it's just really quite cool. Is it not frustrating being a farmer and kind of looking at that going, oh, mate, come on?
No, I think he does it quite well. I think he does it, like, for some people, I feel like you can have some farms being like, oh, I know how to do this, but it's like, well, people watching this have never done it before. So I think he does a really good job of having the right people there. And if you pay enough attention at the end of the credits, you know, he works with the UK Farmers Association and their equivalent of RSPCA and stuff over there. So it's done quite well. And I think for what they show, it's done so much for agriculture, I think. And you have little kids being like, you know, I want to drive a tractor. And I was just at the Easter show the other week at a stall, and people all want to take a photo with this Case tractor. And I was like, this is so weird, because for me, it's just a tractor. Like, but everyone wanted a photo with this tractor. And I was like, people in urban areas really love agriculture, love animals, and just understanding where things come from. Like, it's something that people are curious about. So I think the show's done really well. I think it's done with the right amount of explaining I think it's done well. I don't think it's too patronizing or anything to other farmers. I think
that's good.
Yeah.
New series out very soon too, apparently. Only a month or so away, I'm told. So I'm looking forward to that. Obviously, you're a busy lady. What trends are you keeping your eye on? It can be agriculture related, can be disability related, can just be life in general, or it can be gene editing. What is fascinating you? What's got your attention?
I think at the moment, like, I'm a big LinkedIn person for some reason, accidentally, but LinkedIn, I think, is just a really good value of information for some things, especially following organizations on there, just to kind of get those daily updates on what's going on. So I follow a lot of people in, you know, who've come out of the NDIS task force and things like that, just to kind of see what's going on and you know, just kind of highlight what we're doing to that is practical solutions for us. I guess outside of that trend, I don't know. Like, for me, again, on TikTok, I feel like I just like farming videos all the time. Like, it's so many, like, young people with drones these days, and they just love filming the harvesting or whatever. So, and I'm a very big fan of Patrick the Alpaca. If anyone's come across Patrick, you'll know what I'm talking about.
But it's
farmer from the Mallee, and he has this alpaca with his sheep, and it's quite funny, and it just gives me joy in my day when I see Patrick. So
that's brilliant. I'm gonna check out Patrick the Alpaca. That sounds fantastic. Mate, yeah. What advice would you give someone who was, normally I would say, interested in a job in your industry? I'm gonna give you the total carte blanche to go wherever you want. It can be someone studying not-for-profit, someone working in agriculture, someone with a disability. What advice would you, if you've had one piece of advice, give our listeners one piece of advice, what would it be, Josie?
I think just from the position I'm in now is just plan well, which sounds really boring.
Oh, good one. But no, that's good.
I'm someone who I definitely have 5,000 ideas a day that I think can change the world. It's just how my brain works. And it's stopping and saying, okay, you don't need to necessarily do all this, but write it down anyways, because, you know, just have it write it down, think about it. And it's like, okay, if I haven't thought about it in a week's time, it's obviously not something I can take on. So, but just, I think there's so much value in planning. You know, if you're a young person looking to work in an agricultural kind of business or enterprise, I think just do your background research and don't be afraid to ask the workplace questions. I think that's the biggest thing, especially when I was first coming out of uni and I just kind of took the first job that came to me and I didn't really ask questions or learn that I could actually negotiate when they wanted me to come on and manage 150,000 blueberry trees. I was like, wow, this is really cool. But, you know,
that was
having people around me help think about negotiating and not saying yes all the time. I think especially when you're young, you just feel like you need to be grateful for the first opportunity that's given to you. I think just plan really well and stop and think about it and think, you know, is this the best thing for me? You know, not just financially, but socially. You know, a lot of jobs can be isolating in rural areas, which is a massive problem.
Yeah.
And a big reason for a lot of young people leaving the industry as well. So just think about those things. You know, if I am going to relocate, what's my social support network as well? What's the social support network of the business that I'm going into? Can you find a previous person who's worked for that business and what's their experience? Because there's 1,000 really awesome employees in regional Australia, but also I've had a brother who was put on the side of the road because the farmer was having a bad day in the middle of nowhere. So there's those experiences as well. But it's just, yeah, just do your research and plan really well is probably my key thing, I think.
That is really great advice. I've never heard someone say that. That's awesome. Hey, we always finish with my favorite question. I'm an optimist. I got to figure someone who's studying a PhD and starting up a not-for-profit, aiming to change the world, has to be optimistic by definition. So I'm still going to ask you, what are you optimistic about?
I think a lot of things. I think, like, for me, a lot of things are positively changing, and I think that's just because of our awareness, and that's been a really positive thing for me to see over the last 2 years. But I think, like, you know, down to, I think just the vision of rural and regional people and the work they're doing has been something that I've been really optimistic about, because I think it's something that it's starting to come attention to the broader community. And I think that's really important. So, you know, I'm really optimistic for regional areas. You know, I think I said in somewhere the other day, you know, why can't the next Steve Jobs come from, you know, a town like mine or from a town like Gundawindi or Gunnedah? And I think that's the thing is how do we support and value the opportunity of people in regional areas and, you know, they know the solutions to the challenges in their community as well. How do we help them? So that's what I'm really, I guess, opportunistic about optimistic about. I think there's a lot of that kind of starting to happen and a lot of support there and you know, a lot of things grow in the red dirt, you know, that can grow from it. So I think just, yeah, visibility of rural and regional peoples just can make a lot of really positive change. So, yeah.
I love that. A lot of things grow in the red dirt. That might just be, I don't know, not sort of a motto necessarily, but it's quite a nice little metaphor, I think, and a great way to finish our conversation. But I have learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have as well. Josie Clark, thank you for joining me for The Good Oil.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.